Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. Great to be back with you today. Healthcare in Vermont. That's what we're going to focus on today. It's a subject that will be prominent throughout the program, and the reason it's prominent throughout the program and in future weeks as we roll up to the legislative session, it's because it's such a big issue in Vermont. 20% of our economy is healthcare related. Plus, any issue that touches us in the way that healthcare does is a big issue for you out there as listeners. You have told me that time and time again. So today, Dr. Joe Haddock, he's an independent doctor and board member of Health First. And Health First is an accountable care organization in Vermont. And he'll join us in studio to share with us the issues that independent physicians are having and their role in healthcare delivery and payment reform in Vermont. And after we check in with Talk Media News, more healthcare discussions, this time with Aaron Mansfield of Vermont Digger. We started with Aaron on Friday, had a bad phone connection, so we're picking up on that conversation from Friday. She'll join us and talk about the all-payer waiver. You've been hearing a lot about the all-payer waiver. This is an agreement between the state and the federal government. It's in draft, at least, the agreement. So we're going to talk about what is the all-payer waiver and what does it mean to you. But first, I want to get your opinion on this question. And you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. The question is, no, it's not Kardashians. I'm not asking about Kim Kardashian, why she had $9 million worth of jewels in her apartment in Paris. The question I'm asking is this, and it's political. Are the wheels falling off the Donald Trump campaign? And the reason I'm asking this is that if I look through some of the editorials today, a local editorial, for example, in the Rutland Herald, there's this paragraph. As the wheels come off the Trump-mobile, he has begun to behave in an even more erratic manner, and the defenses offered by his supporters are even more ludicrous. If a genius is someone who loses $1 billion, then passes the bill onto the taxpayers, it's safe to say we can't afford to have many more geniuses at work in America. The Wall Street Journal today opined with a conclusion to their editorial, Mr. Trump has made so many campaign mistakes that it's a miracle he's still competitive. He owes this to the fact that the majority of Americans clearly don't want to vote for Mrs. Clinton. But the hour is late, and if he wants to win, he has to stop pursuing defensive, egotistical sideshows and focus on his plans to make America better. So my question is, are the wheels starting to come off the Donald Trump campaign bus? And if you have an opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. And the reason I say that, it's fair to say that after the first 30 minutes of the debate last week, Donald Trump has been having a horrible, horrible time. You know, in the first 30 minutes of that debate, he dominated that debate when he was talking about trade. But after that 30 minutes, he seemed to get wayward in terms of where he was going. And after the discussion started to shift to women's issues and President Obama's birth certificate, he seemed to be way off kilter. And he ended with this sort of bizarre thing about Miss Universe and this bizarre thing about the fact that he wasn't going to bring up something that was horrible about Hillary Clinton. And if you look at the week, the Trump campaign seems to be way off from where it is supposed to be. I mean, certainly he's off on his income taxes. That has sort of put him on his heels. The Miss Universe controversy, in terms of all the tweeting, all the talk about it, it's a sideshow. It's a distraction. And by the way, it doesn't help him. And yet, he's consistently on that theme. He goes after Clinton's sex lives. The Clinton sex lives. And I got to tell you, Republicans have been trying to do that for years. And guess what? It hasn't worked. And then mocking Hillary Clinton about her bout with pneumonia. Remember when her legs came out from under her as she was getting into the car? Donald Trump mocking that. How does this help him? And all of this is self-inflicted, including the tax problem, by the way. You know, if you know you have if there's going to be an issue with your taxes, as there undoubtedly was going to be an issue because he refused to release his tax forms, if this was going to be an issue, the time for it to come up is 5 months ago, not 5 weeks before the election. If there's an October surprise now, guess where it is? It's in these tax forms. Now, I don't condone who released these tax forms. It's illegal to do what they did. But at the same time, he had to think that these things were going to be released at some time, in some manner. And yet he wasn't prepared for that. And also he isn't prepared in these debates on policy issues because he hasn't spent enough time on those policy issues. So it's been a horrible week for him in terms of what's going on. And on top of this, the headlines today don't help him. Although I've got to say, I think they're being overstated. The headlines say Trump appears to suggest veterans with PTSD are not strong. And here's the quote that headline generated. Basically, here's a quote from Trump, where he responded in the affirmative, adding that there has to be a more – what he was responding to was there has to be a more holistic approach to mental health and behavioral problems of returning veterans. And he says – he agreed with that, and he spoke holistically on that. But here's what he said. He said, when you talk about the mental health problems, when people come back from war and combat and they see things that maybe a lot of folks in this room have seen many times over, and you're strong and you can handle it, but a lot of people can't handle it, Trump said, and they see horror stories, they see events that they couldn't see in a movie, nobody would believe it. And the media has sort of checked in on this and really sort of decided that what he was saying is those that have these sort of mental and behavioral issues aren't strong. They really checked in on this. And his campaign released this from retired General Michael Flynn, who said, the media continues to operate as the propaganda arm of Hillary Clinton as they took Mr. Trump's words out of context in order to deceive voters and veterans, an appalling act that shows they are willing to go to any length to carry the water for their candidate of choice. What do you think about this? I read this quote, and it didn't strike me as he was really saying what the headline suggests he's saying, that Trump appears to suggest veterans with PTSD are not strong. PTSD affects people differently. I think he was trying to say that. But as always with Donald Trump, it comes out in different ways. So the question I have, is the Donald Trump campaign coming off the rails? Let's go to Liz Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. We got Rob, Liz, and Sam on the line. Let's go to Rob in North Carolina.
Hey, Mike.
Good morning.
Longest intro to a question. I think the original question was the wheels going off, right?
Right.
Okay. So, you know, it's funny you mentioned Lieutenant Michael Flynn, because I think we should be asking ourselves, this is a highly decorated, smart general. He was Obama's pick for to take over intelligence command positions. And so the question might be, why is Michael Flynn, a super patriot, why is he siding with Donald Trump? And why would he come out and defend him? I think he sees something up close about Donald Trump that we don't really see. And of course, the press, he's right. The general's right. They will take things out of context. Trump didn't slam the veterans, but they twisted. It's an exaggeration. Yeah, he had a bad week. He had a bad debate, the last half of it. But he's not. His wheels aren't coming off. I just saw Joe Scarborough a little while ago saying he's still in it. I mean, he's up in Ohio by 5 points after one of the worst weeks, Joe said, in political history. So there's something about Donald that keeps people on. But you know what it really is? I have a friend who was a Vietnam veteran. Artillery, and he came back, and he's been a Democrat all his life, Mike. And I'm talking to his brother yesterday, and he's saying, Dave is not going to vote for Hillary. I says, why not? Well, it's about a position on, guess what? Benghazi secrets. So, Mike, you hit it a while ago. Veterans are not, in large droves, are not going to support Hillary Clinton because of her reckless endangerment potential of the soldiers out there, Mike, defending the freedom, then she wants to lead the free world.
Thank you, Rob. Let's go to can I go to Liz here? Liz in Ferrisburg. Liz, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Are the wheels coming off? I don't think so. I go back, but just this morning I said to my husband, I was listening to another radio station in the morning, and a woman was defending Trump, and it was a ridiculous statement that she was saying. It was not even not factual, but it just didn't really make any sense. And I hearken back to when he said I could shoot somebody in Times Square and I'd still get elected. And I think he's right. I think that he can't do anything stupid enough to get him knocked out. And I actually wonder, and here's a conspiracy theory, I wonder if he released these papers. How the heck did anyone get these three papers of his IRS state tax forms? I just wonder if it's going to come out that he actually hit somebody there, released these papers on purpose for him. So that's pretty much what I have to say.
Liz, thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam here on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I got to go with your first caller. And he's absolutely right. And your last statement that you made about them twisting everything in the wind here on that statement about the not strong enough, that what a garbage piece of yellow journalism that's going out there on that. That is just, those people should really feel ashamed of themselves. They really should feel ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much Trump, but people that wrote that should really think about what they did, how they twisted that, made that sound. That, to me, is about as ugly as it gets. Now, as far as the wheels coming off the bus, don't think so. They should, you know, the Clintons put up the shiny object up there and went with Miss Universe. He took the bait. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. He took the bait on that. And he's kind of one of these guys. Hey, you're offending me. You know, this is a scenario. She did not take a spelling test before that pageant. She was hired for her looks. And that's what he was saying. She was hired for her looks. He wanted her to take off weight. If she was playing in the NFL, she would have been benched. That's fact. That's how that worked. It's not nothing to do with being derogatory or anything. That's what you're signing up for. And they're trying to hit him on all these situations. All he does is hire pretty hostesses. Well, when you look at the newscast, and you look at the women on the newscast, how many of them have a wart on their chin with hair coming out of it? I bet you not too many. So, you know, when you know, everybody should be, if everybody feels that everybody should hire everybody, no matter what they look like, well, you know, maybe the media should hire people that look that way, too. You know what I'm saying? Have you got a face for radio, Mike, or what?
Sam, I don't know where to. Can you just hold on for a second? Because I'm trying to figure out where to go with this, and here's the reason I'm thinking about it. I have a really fundamental problem with trying to shame somebody, whether it's weight or anything like that. But you do make a point with people in the media, whether it's national media or it's local media. You know, they hire people that are fairly good looking, I guess is the word. So what happens after when you don't become good looking? Do you leave your position or you do something else? And I guess I'm struggling with that, in that I really really don't like people who shame people because of weight, because of looks, because of anything. But does our society place too much emphasis on the fact? You go to any sort of magazine, any glamour magazine or anything, and the women are razor thin. Everybody is looking at this. We had a guest on last week that talked about the fact that people are shamed about their weight all the time, and this causes eating disorders. You're hitting on something that's there, but I'm not sure I'm agreeing with you, Sam.
Unfortunately, I'm not the one that generates it. Table one in any restaurant across this country, you will not see a family of four that's overweight. You're going to see good-looking young people sitting at that table as you walk in the door. Any host or hostess has been trained to do that. Put the good-looking people up front. They sell the restaurant. That's the way it is. Put the good people on the counter in the makeup department. They're going to sell the makeup. That we didn't create this, you know, and he didn't create it. And what you're saying is, you know, like, does he bash people on it? He's a New Yorker. You're getting New York. That's the thing. You know, you're not getting Vermont. You're getting New York. And he is a New Yorker, and that's what you get. And maybe the rest of the country really can't put up with New Yorkers, and a lot of them can't. So maybe that's, you know, what you're getting a real New Yorker. Hillary pretends to be a New Yorker.
Thanks, Sam, for your phone call. Again, I just can't. I can't go there. I just. I think there's something fundamentally wrong when you sort of bash somebody because of their weight, and bash somebody because of their looks. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, I only got about a few minutes here.
That's all right. I can be quicker than that. First off, when somebody keeps telling you what he is like as an individual and a personality, believe him. Stop giving him the credit of the doubt. Over and over and over, Donald Trump has shown us, he's told us what he is like as a person. Believe him. Take him at his word for it. And as far as Benghazi goes, maybe we need another 20 investigations and we can finally find something that Clinton did wrong with Benghazi. But, you know, let's keep investigating it, because sooner or later we'll turn up something like she sneezed at the wrong time or something. Thank you.
Thank you, Rama. With Benghazi, I think the issue is not the investigations. I think the with me at least, the issue with Benghazi is the impact that it's had on those people who serve in dangerous positions throughout the world. They're wondering whether Washington has their back. And if you look at Benghazi, it was abandonment of people in need. And that's the issue with Benghazi. It doesn't need any more investigation. Who was at the top? It was Hillary Clinton. But I've said this before. It isn't only Hillary Clinton. The military brass let those people down, too, when they were calling for air support that was necessary during this time. Do we need another investigation? No. But I'm telling you, this has a huge impact on those military members and other members that are defending our country or are in dangerous spots in the world, that America didn't come to the aid of people in need. And that is a big deal. That's why Benghazi is important. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It is my great pleasure to have in our WDEV studios Dr. Joe Haddock. He's a independent physician, but he's also a board member of Health First. And what the topic we're going to be talking about today are independent physicians and their role in healthcare delivery and payment reform in Vermont. Good morning, Dr. Haddad.
Good morning.
Joe, just so that we all know, what is Health First?
Well, Health First is an organization of independent physicians, both primary care and specialty care, organized 5 or 6 years ago to give us a voice in healthcare reform, in payment reform, in negotiating with payers. Independent physicians have always been kind of like herding cats, you know. And so we needed to have an organization where we could all get together and make our feelings known and to have a representative to work with the Green Mountain Care Board, with the state, with various payers, and with insurance companies.
And so when you form Health First, is Health First an accountable care organization? Is that what it is? An ACO?
No, it's not an accountable care organization.
Okay. And with these physicians, the reason I ask that question is that there were a couple of accountable care organizations. There still maybe more. They've sort of merged into one that's out there. Does that merger into One Care Vermont have an impact with an accountable care? And I'll get to what an accountable care organization is in a minute, but does that have an impact on independent physicians?
Well, if the three independent groups with ACOs in the state do merge to form Vermont Care Organization, VCO, led right now by the leaders of One Care, then I think that would deal with independent docs, and independent docs would have to figure out whether or not it would be something that would benefit them or whether it would not.
And that seems to be, when I read a little bit about this and when I was doing my research last night when I was reading, it seems like the Green Mountain Care Board is headed into merging these ACOs or trying to merge these ACOs into one entity that would represent all people, both independent docs and hospital docs, I guess I'll call them in terms of doing that. Is that the direction you're seeing healthcare going?
Well, there has been a movement in the last couple of years in this state to form a single entity to enable the state to qualify for a Medicare waiver for an all-payer model. And the goal has been to have that involve hospital-employed physicians, independent physicians, as well as physicians who work for FQHCs. Mm-hmm. The three ACOs involved, One Care, which is represents University of Vermont, Dartmouth, Central Vermont, and several other hospitals and their employed physicians. CHAC, which is the ACO for the FQHC organizations in the state, to which most of the FQHCs belong, but not all. And then lastly, Health First, or its ACO, which represents the independent physicians. Now, a bunch of us have spent better part of 15 or 16 months trying to work out how to make this all work for everybody and how to make it result in better quality at lower cost. Quite a difficult task.
One of the things, so let me ask you this question because this is sort of the crux of the question. When we talk about independent doctors, what are some of the issues that we're talking about?
Well, independent docs offer a different model of care. They offer a different point of view. I would say small independent physician practices in many ways are more agile than large medical groups in that they can respond to change much more quickly. And I would say they are positioned to take advantage of some of the new programs that come along without having to change a whole big organization. The independent docs in the state I would point out our ACO in 2014 and 2015, the latter data just having been published a couple of weeks ago, the independent doctor's ACO is the ACO in this state providing the highest quality care at the lowest cost. And in 2014, the only year when there were three Medicare ACOs in the state, the independent physician's ACO, the Accountable Care Organization of the Green Mountains, was the ACO for Medicare patients with the highest quality and the lowest cost. Now, Well, and the VCO, the Vermont Care Organization, would like to have independent physicians in it, partly because they do provide such high-quality care at a lower cost, and they need the attributed lives to have enough patients to qualify for the all-payer model.
One of the things that I'm interested in is that you have sort of the independent docs who are, as you say, providing high-quality care. With this sort of movement to go towards consolidation, whether it's ACO consolidation, accountable care organizations consolidation, or consolidation with larger hospitals and those sort of things. There's been a lot of talk about UVM Medical Center, for example, buying up practices and that sort of thing. Is that good or bad?
Well, it's a good question. One of my goals, now I'll be 70 this winter. I've been practicing primary care in Vermont for 38 years in the same location in Williston. And I've seen practices get bought by hospitals. I've seen hospitals jettison practices. And it kind of goes back and forth over the years, so I don't know what will happen down the road. I think the Accountable Care Act thought that one of the important things was for all physicians to work under these large organizations to provide higher quality at lower cost. One of the architects of that Accountable Care Act, Dr. Bob Coker, wrote in an editorial in the Wall Street Journal just in August that he was wrong about that, and that in retrospect, after 5 or 6 years of data, it's his opinion that independent small practices do provide higher quality care at less cost with a more intimate relationship with their patients. And he rues the day that he pushed all physicians being in large, you know, accountable care organizations or large hospital groups or whatever.
You had mentioned that independent physicians have this more flexibility, have higher quality in terms of some of the statistics that you talked about. What about reimbursement? Because I hear a lot about this. There are two ways that I hear about this. One, they'll leave an independent doctor and go to a doctor who is affiliated with a hospital, and all of a sudden their costs of care go up. The bills are higher. The other thing that I hear is that when this consolidation happens, immediately the cost of health care goes up because the reimbursement mechanisms by the federal government and others, insurance companies too, has a higher reimbursement level at the sort of the hospital level than it does at the independent care level. Am I off base there?
No, you're on base. One of the things, but you have to differentiate reimbursement to physicians who work for academic hospitals,
right,
versus reimbursement to physicians who work for community hospitals versus reimbursement to independent doctors. And for hospitals, there's sometimes an associated facility fee, which independent doctors don't get. And then by a couple of the major payers in our state, reimbursement for the same procedure to physicians who work for academic centers is quite a bit higher. The legislature asked the Green Mountain Care Board and the insurance companies to look at that in an effort to study pay parity, and we're still waiting to see what the results of that might be.
You had mentioned, and I think I read last night, that there an issue you, your organization has an issue with the reimbursement process. And I think I read it that somebody in your organization called the reimbursement process a shell game. I'm trying to figure out, is it this disparity between the academic hospitals and the independent physicians that is the problem with the reimbursement, or is it something else?
Well, I'd say that's one of the problems. to generalize, our medical reimbursement system in this country is a mess. And that would be just one of the places we see that. It's interesting that the same insurance company might pay a widely variable reimbursement for the same test depending on who does it. A PSA at the various hospitals around the state is reimbursed at a different rate by a single insurance company, and sometimes those differences can be as much as 150 or 200%.
And what are you calling for? What is Health First calling for in terms of reform in that area?
Well, I think transparency would be a good thing, and I think to have it fair for physicians who do the same work to be reimbursed at the same rate by the same payer.
So pay equity is what we're talking – payment equity is what we're talking about, no matter where you are working as a physician.
Yes, and now we all understand that a hospital – and I'm not here to impugn anyone else. I'm just speaking pro us, not
right.
anti anybody else. But we all understand that if you're a hospital with a big emergency room and an ICU and all that stuff, there has to be money to support that. But for the simple visit for pneumonia or sore throat or something, the reimbursement ought to be similar.
One of the things that I've heard from independent providers, independent physicians, is the reimbursement level of Medicaid. Many feel that the reimbursement level forces them to decide whether to take Medicaid patients or not, because it, according to independent physicians that I've spoken to, the Medicaid reimbursement, not only independent physicians, it's other people, it's other docs elsewhere too, the reimbursement level is too low. What's sort of your take on that?
Well, I'd agree with that. First of all, when we first had Medicaid, one of the founding physicians in my practice in Williston felt that, well, always before he gave that care away free, and now at least he got overhead. But we're at a point where Medicaid reimburses such a low level. Excuse me. Medicaid reimburses at such a low level, it makes it hard for many practices to continue and to be viable. For example, some of those practices you heard about, the pediatric practice in Franklin County, with 60 or 70% Medicaid patients, could no longer function. And in large part, that's because in 2013 and 2014, there was a federal enhancement of Medicaid that brought its reimbursement up to the level of Medicare. That sunsetted at the end of 2014 and remains below that. I'll give the legislature some credit because up until October 1st, Medicaid was reimbursed at about 82% of Medicare, and the state legislature funded enough to increase that reimbursement to about 91% of Medicare. So that's the one area where that might have improved. I would take a look at our own practice, and we have a fairly heterogeneous payer mix, which is advantageous, and we're lucky in that. If we were all Medicaid, we would pay the overhead but pay no providers. So everybody wonders where the money is going to come from, and I have no idea. My big – I don't want to get you off topic here, but my big mission in all this is try to preserve primary care. And with Medicaid reimbursement where it is, and other reimbursements where they are, primary care is in a bad situation.
Let me go there because it's a question I was going to ask later on, but let's go there right now. There are three sort of legs to the stool of healthcare, at least in my mind, in my simple mind, in trying to figure out healthcare and figure out the various issues there. But it's accessibility, accessing health care, its affordability, and its quality. At one time, accessibility was sort of defined by the fact that if you had insurance or not. But in Vermont, 96% or so of people have insurance of some kind, whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, or private insurance, or through the health exchange, they have insurance. But I'm hearing more and more about a lack of access because people can't get in to see primary care doctors. There's a lack of primary care doctors. It's a, you know, if you've got one, you're great, and you hope he never retires. If you don't have one, getting in to see a primary care doctor because they're jammed is getting, at least what I'm hearing, is nearly impossible. Is that the issue you're talking about?
Yes. Primary care, and I would say he or she or him or her, I think a lot of primary care can be done by nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. In our office, we have six who are very dedicated and very determined to take good care of their patients. However, you need some physicians to be in primary care, and very few go into it. One of my goals would be to see primary care physicians reimbursed at a rate similar to hospitalists or emergency room physicians, because those two fields are the fields that compete with primary care for new residents or new physicians to enter that field. But the reimbursement for primary care is some, let's say, 60-65% of that of the other two fields. And if they were reimbursed at the same level as those two fields, that would at least remove the financial barrier to going into primary care. A lot of these students are $200,000 or $300,000 in debt, so that makes a big difference. I would say another thing that's inhibiting people going to primary care is the non-reimbursed or minimally reimbursed imposed overhead by the various programs. And you've heard all these acronyms that impose upon us the bureaucratic responsibility to punch the computer several times, gather electronic data so that somebody can measure it but not reimburse for it. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming an inhibiting factor. When the medical students in our office, they see us filling out these dumb forms or the seemingly dumb forms and clicking boxes in the computer, which really have little to do with quality of care. One of the things that's leading to physician burnout a lot is the electronic medical record. Not so much the record itself, but what it has enabled other entities to do to impose more work on the physicians, and especially primary care.
One of the things where the state is headed is the all-payer waiver. And the all-payer waiver is based upon sort of preventative care. It would seem to me that would fall on the primary care physician, wherever that physician is located. So you're going to need, it seems to me, more primary care physicians. How do you do that?
Well, over the past few years, there's been many programs thought to enhance primary care, be it meaningful use, the federal government's way to pay for electronic health records, be it PQRS, which is a quality thing we do for insurance companies, be it the blueprint in this state, which is a very nice thing but not reimbursed very well, be it ACOs and their data. Virtually all of those add more work with minimal reimbursement. I don't know where people are going to get the money from, I'll be honest. But all of the new health care reform ideas by the policy wonks and the government and whomever, all of the new programs are based on a strong primary care foundation. And while all speak strongly of supporting it, no one has really done anything to support it or to help increase the number of primary care physicians or new physicians going into primary care. I think when we started the all-payer model a year ago, March, the goals, as stated then, would have enhanced primary care reimbursement such that I think we would be able to attract a lot more physicians to go into it. I would say that evolved over the 15 months to a level where now we're all waiting to see what payers are involved and what level it's going to be. But I've lost some of that optimism.
I want to come back to the all-payer model in just a moment. We're speaking with Dr. Joe Haddock. He's a independent physician. He's also a board member of Health First, Vermont Health First. When we come back, we'll turn to the issue of all-payer waiver. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with me is Dr. Joe Haddock. He's an independent physician. He's a primary care physician as well, but he's also a board member of Health First, and we're talking about independent physicians and their roles in the healthcare delivery system and payment reform in Vermont. And Dr. Haddock has a cold. I think he needs to go to a primary care physician here as he's speaking with me. But let's go back to the all-payer. We left just before the break talking about all-payer. What is your group's concerns with the all-payer waiver?
Well, our group was very optimistic at the onset of the discussions when Vermont started to apply for the all-payer waiver. And the interest at that time, and the goal was to have 80% of Vermonters with Medicare involved, and that was when we were discussing a Medicare waiver. But now for an all-payer model waiver, it would be good to get 50-80% of all Vermont involved. One of the difficulties that has arisen is there's not a lot of interest on the part of the commercial insurers at this time. Medicaid is still figuring out what their next plan will be. And currently, to my knowledge, and I'm not expert at this, the involved patients attributed in the new all-payer model would be Medicare patients and some of the Blue Cross Blue Shield patients who are insured through the exchange. So at a practice like mine, that would only be 30% perhaps of all the patients. And with so few involved, it's hard to then change the way practices perform and the way reimbursement is accomplished. You know, everybody's goal now is payment for quality or reimbursement for quality, population health care. And despite all the interest of that in the last 4 or 5 years, our office and most offices are still 95% fee-for-service. Moving away from that would be a great goal, as most of us agree, but the administrative and bureaucratic obstructions to that are quite difficult to overcome. I think the state has tried hard. Algo Bay is an endless cheerleader or proponent for it, but there are lots of things he can't fix either.
One of the things I've always been curious about the all-payer, let's say we go down this route and the savings are not there, the health outcomes are not what we expected, and the efficiencies are not there. What happens then?
I don't know. I'll be honest. And right now, I'm in charge of our office, and we see about 40,000 patients a year. It's impossible to make a 2-year plan. We make a budget every year, but you try to follow it, but right now it's impossible to know what's coming down the pike. I think the state has worked very hard to achieve this all-payer model, and we're waiting to see what the details are. You know, it just got agreed to in the last week or 10 days. But as we look for those details, there's so few patients involved, it's going to be hard to see what will happen with it or without it. Many of us in Vermont, in primary care especially, we're interested in a program called CPC Plus, which is Comprehensive Primary Care Plus, which Medicare was offering this summer. And our state didn't qualify as one of the regions. And I think in part because the state was working really hard on the all-payer model. So I don't know what will be the result, if it works or doesn't work.
One of the things I've been critical about, at least here on his program, is that politicians in particular seem to overpromise what is coming down the pike, and I don't want I'm not saying you should get into this political discussion that I'm having, but they always overpromise sort of the affordability of or the savings of various health care schemes. Now, the savings is purported in this in the all payer is $10 billion over 10 years, which averages about $1 billion a year in savings. I find that awful hard to believe that there'll be $1 billion in savings in a healthcare system. Am I just being off base here?
Well, I think you're right to be incredulous a little bit. And I think there's no way we can realize that unless we get an all-payer model with all the payers involved, most of the patients involved, so you can then achieve some of these efficiencies. But that's a lot to expect. I agree.
One of the things we talk about is access that I talked about, access, affordability, and quality. Here is my impression, and I'd be curious with your impression. Like I said, I think we have an access problem that's different in the past. It's not insurance. It's access to primary care and some specialists, by the way. Affordability, we're still working on in terms of having health care affordable for people. And quality, it's my impression that we have good quality of health care in this state. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think the quality of health care in Vermont is among the best in the country, and the cost of health care in Vermont is among the lowest. So it's hard to improve on those things without a big change in how the health care is reimbursed. I do think our big problem with accessibility is lack of enough primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, and I think that's the biggest problem to solve.
One of the things I'm curious, as I was reading on your website the other night, the Health First website, not your practice website, but the Health First website, is where are we going here? What's, from Health First perspective, what's the future direction that we need to go in for your organization?
Well, I admit we're at a crossroads now. We were supported in large part by the SIM grant, and now we have to figure out how to be self-supporting and continue our mission of supporting primary care, working on reimbursement for primary care, but also being engaged and working with the state in the Vermont Care Organization and whatever the all-payer model, if it occurs, so that I think our point right now is to maximize our leverage to deal with payers, with the Green Mountain Care Board, with the state, and see if we can continue to do that.
Dr. Joe Haddock, thank you very much for being with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Dr. Joe Haddock, who is a primary care physician, also an independent physician, and a board member of Health First. And we've been speaking about independent physicians and their role in the healthcare delivery system and also payment reform for these independent physicians. It seems to be a bone of contention in that there are different payment systems here in the system. Coming up, Talk Media News, and then Erin Mansfield, Vermont Digger reporter, and we'll be talking to her about the all-payer waiver. And again, the reason why we're spending so much time on healthcare every week, and we usually spend, we dedicate a day for healthcare, is the fact that it is such a huge issue in Vermont. Not only that it touches your lives every single day, but it also touches the economy. 20% of Vermont's economy is healthcare related. So this is why it's important. This is why I want to provide you with as much information about what's going on. Sometimes it's all gobbledygook out there in terms of what people are talking about, what people are saying. As the doctor just said, Dr. Joe Haddock, it's a bunch of acronyms that nobody understands. We're trying to bring some understanding to this major issue in Vermont. And by the way, you're not hearing a lot about it on the campaigns, and that is another reason why we're trying to bring this to light. So coming up, we'll have Erin Mansfield talking about Vermont about the Vermont all-payer waiver. And also, we'll get back to, I left a lot of you hanging on the Donald Trump as the wheels come off on the Donald Trump campaign. We'll get back to that at the end of the program. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. We've had a glorious past, but we're celebrating the future. 85 years, WDEV News Radio. We're broadcasting from WDEV AM 550 from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island and Pond. And, of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Now we turn our attention to national, sometimes international issues. And on the line is our colleague and from Talk Media News, Victoria Jones. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning.
Victoria, we're having a vice presidential debate tonight. What do we expect?
Well, let's see. These two guys, Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, Democrat, and the debaters in Virginia, Governor Mike Pence of Indiana, Republican, they are the two vice presidential candidates. They're not dramatic guys. I mean, Tim Kaine's been likened to a sweater vest, and Governor Mike Pence has likened himself to Rush Limbaugh on decaf. He's a former radio host. So that's what they kind of, you know, they're kind of genial and laid back, and they're both very religious, so that's the start. Before everybody sets the snooze button or decides to go and watch the 31 Days of Halloween movies on Sci-Fi, don't, because they're not the main focus. Trump and Clinton are. They've got to defend them, and they've got to attack. So it could get quite lively.
It is going to be interesting, and what's also interesting and what's happening on the top of the card there in terms of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton is the line that Rudy Giuliani used yesterday that Donald Trump is a genius. Was that a mistake, you think, for the campaign? Because it seems like the genius line is being used against Trump now.
Yeah, it's being used against him. But of course, he's called himself brilliant since then. I mean, he's repeatedly used the word brilliant in his usage of over $900 million loss in his 1995 taxes. So I guess he's not denying it now. In business loss, which most of us would probably be a bit embarrassed about. It was a mistake, but Giuliani is saying it is genius. It seems to be hitting undecided voters not too well. Obviously, his followers like it. They like pretty much everything he does. So, you know, he's okay with them, but it's undecided voters. For undecided voters, it seems to be hitting many of them. I don't know about all of them, but many of them in a not so good way, in the sense of that, well, we pay taxes, we pay for the roads, we pay for the bridges, we pay for the FAA and all these things. He's not contributing, but he's using them.
And where he's got to be worried about this is in those swing states, I think, because he'll take the red states, it looks like, as red states, and Hillary take the blue states as blue states. Where he's got to be concerned about this is in the Ohios, for example, or the North Carolinas, where people are the independents. You're absolutely right. He's got his people. They're going to stick with him no matter what. But where he needs to get, what he needs to get are those independents out there. And if in their mind, if they say that I'm paying taxes, why isn't he? He has a problem, doesn't he?
Yes, he does have a problem with that. He had a problem with that, in the same way that he has a problem with women voters, with the repeated drumbeat coming out of the things that he said about women, and not only the sexual things that he said about women, but repeatedly calling women fat and body-shaming women. You know, when you've got the average size of women in this country being somewhere between a 12 and a 16, women don't want to be body-shamed, particularly by a man who's borderline obese. What is that?
Yeah, I'm always cautious about doing that, given the fact that I've gained some weight as well. Let me ask this question. In Syria,
yeah,
it's a mess, but the U.S. is breaking off talks with Russia. Why?
U.S. is breaking off talks with Russia partly because they think it's pointless. Now, Secretary of State John Kerry has, because the talks on getting the ceasefire going again are getting nowhere, is what the State Department would say. John Kerry spoke today, criticized Russia today for pointedly ignoring the Syrian government's use of chlorine gas and barrel bombs against its own citizens, and he didn't leave much hope for getting back to talking again. He was speaking in Brussels before the opening of a conference on Afghanistan organized by the European Union. Now, he said that the U.S. would continue efforts to end the fighting in Syria through the U.N., but he didn't really have much hope of persuading Russia to give up its support of the government of President Assad of Syria. He said, "We acknowledge in sorrow, and I have to tell you, outrage, that Russia has turned a blind eye to Assad's," he doesn't call him President Assad usually, "to Assad's deplorable use of chlorine gas and barrel bombs against his people. Together, the Syrian regime and Russia have rejected diplomacy and seem to have chosen instead to continue their pursuit of a military victory over the broken bodies, bombed-out hospitals, and traumatized children of a long-suffering land." And that pretty much sums up what it is.
Are we headed for another Cold War? It just seems to me that our relations with Russia have deteriorated to the point where I'm wondering what sort of relationships we will have with them in the future.
Well, it's not warm. You know, the relations are not warm. Now, it's interesting because at the same time, virtually, that the U.S. broke off talks with Russia just before that announcement, Putin suspended a treaty with Washington on cleaning up weapons-grade plutonium. So that was sort of saying, well, I'll use nuclear disarmament as a new bargaining chip in this, dispute with the U.S. over Syria and Ukraine. And then in the middle of all this, the State Department said that the top U.S. diplomat on Europe, which includes Russia, is going to Moscow this week to hold talks with senior Russian officials on Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. Hmm. So I wouldn't fancy being that person because I don't think those talks are going to be terribly easy.
I've got two questions left, Victoria. The one is real and the other is sort of a joke, but
yeah.
The Supreme Court of the United States won't hear Obama's immigration plan. What does that mean?
It means that for 4 million people, I think it was people or families, let me get my numbers right. I want to get my numbers right. 4 million people who've lived illegally in the U.S. So basically what it was to spare about 4 million immigrants who've lived in the country illegally since at least 2010, but they've got no criminal record. They had to have children who are citizens or lawful permanent residents. The plan was designed to let them get into a program that would shield them from deportation and get them work permits. Now, the justices declined to rehear a bid to revive this plan to spare them from deportation. So in theory, the original decision of a lower court is now final, and they could start to be deported. And so you're going to see families split up of children who either have legal residency or are U.S. citizens, and parents who are here illegally, have no criminal records, and have lived here since at least 2010. Some of them much, much, much longer than that could be deported.
And lastly, I'm curious, because I haven't had a chance to ask this question today to anybody. It's sort of under foreign policy. Why would anyone travel to Paris with $8 million worth of jewelry and not expect something bad to happen?
Especially if they Snapchat and Instagram and tweet and do everything else about it. I don't know. Kim Kardashian did have security, but it seems as though the security wasn't on. And the page 6 in the New York Post has an interesting piece today saying that French police, and they tend to have good sources, French police suspect that the 5 alleged robbers who held up Kim Kardashian may have made off with $8 or $9 million worth of jewelry, had contact with her security and were tipped off about her security procedures, according to a source. Also, that one or more of the armed robbers who were dressed up as police officers could have been a previous bodyguard, and that the concierge who was tied up may have been just for show.
It gets curiouser. As with anything dealing with the Kardashians, it gets curiouser and curiouser as the events unfold here.
So, indeed.
Hey, Victoria Jones, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Media News. Coming up, we'll speak with Aaron Mansfield, Vermont Digger reporter, and we'll talk about the all-payer waiver. We're continuing to discuss health care today because it is important to our lives here in Vermont. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have on the phone line Aaron Mansfield, Vermont Digger reporter. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. Our topic today is the all-payer waiver. And the reason we're talking about this is because politicians and others are talking about this is the future of health care in Vermont. So, Aaron, my question is, let's just review. What is the all-payer waiver? And what does it allow?
Okay, great. So the all-payer waiver is an agreement between the state and the federal government that allows the state to make some changes in its health care system, in a nutshell. What it allows the state to do is pay doctors essentially a monthly fee for taking care of patients, as opposed to paying for each test, each procedure, each surgery, each this. It allows the state doctors to have a little bit more flexibility in what their Medicare patients are allowed to do, such as it would help allow doctors to send their patient to a nursing home after they maybe had a surgery in a hospital, and right now Medicare laws make it very hard to do that. But the big thing about this is it sets up it brings all the doctors in Vermont together, or at least it seeks to, over time, bring all the doctors in Vermont together, and they would coordinate care under a giant ACO that is expected to be the Vermont Care Organization.
Does it brings all doctors under this umbrella? Does it bring all patients under this umbrella?
That depends on who your doctor is.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, most of us who have commercial insurance, or even, if you have Medicaid insurance, it probably says on your insurance card who your primary care provider is. And as it turns out, in healthcare policy, the name on your card is actually a pretty big deal, because who your primary care provider is determines whether you're in this ACO. So if you have a doctor, who's a hospital-employed doctor, most likely that doctor is part of OneCare, and you would be you would be under this system. If you have an independent doctor, it would depend on whether or not that doctor chose to contract with this. And right now, if your primary care physician is at a community health center, that's kind of up in the air right now. They're scheduled to join the hospital-affiliated doctors in this giant ACO called the Vermont Care Organization, but that hasn't quite happened yet.
We just had a representative for the independent physicians, and there's a lot of concerns that they have about the all-payer, but what does this draft agreement, what does it mean to have a draft agreement? What happens next?
Basically, in less than a month, the state and meaning the Shulman administration and the Green Mountain Care Board, could sign this agreement. The agreement puts the state on track to put 30% of health care providers under this new organization in 2018. So signing it really accepts a deal that's been negotiated for about 2 years. It puts the state on track to implement it, although at the same time, there are about a if a new governor comes in, that governor could give 180 days notice to get out of the deal. And because it wouldn't start until 2018, literally the next governor, 6 months into his or her term, could get out of it, and it wouldn't be much different. Now, what is attached to the all-payer model is that it was being negotiated in conjunction with what you know as the Global Commitment Waiver, which was scheduled to end at the end of, I think it was 2017. And one of the big things that's kind of baked into this deal, it would be continuance of funding for certain state health reform programs that without this all-payer model, the state might not be able to get. And so those are things such as the Blueprint for Health, supports and services at home, which is a home health care program to help seniors age in place as opposed to in the hospital or a nursing home.
Mm-hmm. The 30%, you said that they have agreed to bring about 30% into this new waiver. Isn't that a pretty easy lift given the fact that OneCare is the two major academic hospitals that belong to OneCare is UVM Medical Center and Dartmouth Hitchcock. Is that a easy lift in order to get that 30%?
In the grand scheme of things, it definitely is, right? Because sometimes when we think of doctors, we think that, you know, they're going to have a roll call vote of every single doctor in the state. And that's not really what they mean. What they mean is that a group of doctors representing 30% of doctors, and OneCare does represent 30% of primary care doctors. So that group of doctors, if they choose to go through a series of agreements with the state to set up this model, then the state has what it needs.
The plan is to have it signed in 3 weeks, according to what I read in your article. The plan is to have it signed in 3 weeks, and then have, during those 3 weeks, have three public meetings. Isn't this quick with a major sort of change in our healthcare system?
I mean, there are certainly people who feel it's quick. It sounds like you might think it's pretty quick. There was one meeting last night in Norwich. There are two coming up. One's in Chittenden County, and one will be at the Rutland Hospital. And we were able to post those on our website in case people want to go to that. There are also regular Green Mountain Care Board meetings that are, even though they're kind of regular, they're still dedicated to all payer. And that is a criticism that has come from, for example, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, Don Turner, the House Minority Leader, over the timing of this. I would leave that up to the public to decide if this is too short. There is a public comment period open for the Green Mountain Care Board and with the administration. So even if you can't make it to those meetings, you can write in. And I do intend to look at those and see what the public is saying.
The governor says, Governor Shumlin says it will save $10 billion over 10 years. That means approximately $1 billion a year. How is that savings achieved?
So what I would bring you back to is a graph. We talk about the slope of a line, right? Right now, they are projecting that Medicare spending could go up by 6% a year, right? So that's a 6%, that's a slope of an increase of 6% per year. And what they're proposing to do is reduce that to 3.5%, right? So that's a little bit of a flatter line. Mm-hmm. And so the difference between those two lines, they're saying over 10 years, is about $10 billion. Now, if you're talking about the slope of a line like that, the first year is not going to be $1 billion in savings, right? Maybe the third year you'd have $1 billion, and then the year after that you'd have more than that, and your savings would go up. Now, to be clear, that is a statistic. That seems to be kind of a... just a routine statistic that's used to understand the impact of this. The deal is not for 10 years. So that's one of the things that I want to make sure you know. The deal would be for 5 years starting in 2018. And the 10-year estimate started in 2015, which we're not in anymore. So the idea is that they're proposing to lower the slope of the line in healthcare cost growth. It's not really money right back in your pockets, but it's money that you might not otherwise have to spend, and that is that's what they're proposing.
So let me ask this question, because that's the normal thing that a consumer reading this article would say. Well, there's going to be $10 billion in savings. That must come to my pocket. How does it come to my pocket?
The same way any other money in the economy comes to your pocket, right? My spending is your income. Your spending is someone else's income. The savings might come to the federal government. If it's Medicare savings, that's essentially savings for the Medicare Trust Fund. It might mean that commercial insurance rates might not go up quite as fast. But really what's going on is that if you're in a capitated system where you're giving doctors monthly payments, then the monthly payments you give them could just go up by 3.5% a year, and that's the difference. It's a little bit more regulated because you're regulating a monthly payment for a patient as opposed to, whether or not you want to give them eight physical therapy visits instead of nine, or, five instead of 10.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask this, Aaron, because it's sort of the fundamental question. What happens if we go down this route and the savings aren't achievable and the healthcare outcomes aren't appreciably better and the efficiencies just aren't there, and we've sort of rigged our whole healthcare system in this direction? What happens after 5 years that this just doesn't work?
That's an interesting thing, right? Who would decide that it didn't work? Would you go back to the drawing board? Would you keep a similar system but tweak it again? Healthcare reform in the United States has been changing a lot. And when something doesn't work, it changes again. And then if it does work, it still changes to make it better. And that's kind of just the nature of healthcare reform. I can't predict what'll happen in 5 years. I'm not
right.
I'm not a betting gal, but. It sounds like what you're raising is whether or not people are concerned of going down a road where they don't know what's at the end of it. And I think that's one of the reasons that's one of the reasons that public comments are important. And that's one of the reasons that, they're actually holding these public forums, is to try to allay people's fears.
What do doctors think about this in general? I just spoke with the independent doctors. They thought this had a lot of promise, but they're less enthused now about the all-payer waiver. What do other doctors think about this?
Right. So the doctors are under these bigger umbrella organizations called ACOs. OneCare Vermont, the biggest ACO in the state, that is, their CEO says he's cautiously optimistic. Community Health Accountable Care, which represents the community health centers, they say they're still looking into what it all means. And I mean, that's basically it. We're not really we're probably not going to hear from individual doctors. We're going to hear from their bigger entities that are representing them. And independent doctors, they're always a little different from the hospital-employed doctors, who are in turn different from the community health center. So you are going to hear varied. And independent doctors who are used to being independent, who are used to running their own small businesses, you should expect them to have a little bit different of a view than a more consolidated entity like a hospital or a community health center.
One of the things that you hear and you read, whether it's after your stories on Vermont Digger or not, is that did officials address the angst that seniors have with concerns of Medicare changes?
Yeah. I mean, because seniors love their Medicare, right? It covers people over 65 or if they're disabled, and people, tend to really like it. The one thing that you will hear repeated is that the state of Vermont is not touching Medicare money. Medicare money would go straight to the ACO. And that the state of Vermont cannot reduce benefits. The federal government would not allow them to do that. I would ask you, do seniors feel good about that? I personally am not a Medicare patient, so I don't know how to quite get in their heads.
What are you insinuating here, Aaron, that I'm close to that?
No,
let me...
Right, because I have commercial insurance, right? So my life is a little different. From
okay. Sure. Well, I don't have Medicare yet.
Yeah. So I didn't even think of that, Mike. That's hilarious.
One of the things that has been, I think, a concern is there are... Everything's moving towards, as you mentioned, at least the direction that I think that people are talking about is moving to a single ACO and whether it's OneCare or something else. But the consensus, I think, is that it's probably going to move towards OneCare, which is dominated by the two academic hospitals, which are UVM Medical Center and Dartmouth-Hitchcock. What happens with the roles of the smaller hospitals as they move into these giant, as they move into these ACOs that are dominated by UVM Medical Center and Dartmouth-Hitchcock?
That is a good question, and that's something I want to keep following. I honestly don't have the answer, but, you know, some people would prefer to be independent, some people wouldn't. I don't know the share of that percentage of people who prefer to be independent.
It was an interesting sort of thing here that when I was speaking with the independent doctor representative, what he said, Dr. Joe Haddock, was that, and he's with Health First, what he said was that quality is the aspect of quality, the aspect of being flexible, are all in the aspect of cost, are all in the favor of these sort of small independent entities. And yet the federal government and the state are moving towards this consolidation model. And this consolidation model, I don't know if we've had the opportunity, we will over the next 3 weeks look at this, because this is a consolidation model. Is there a fundamental belief or angst out there whether we're going in the right direction, or have you picked that up in your reporting?
Let me just make sure I understand. You're asking if there's an angst over the rush to consolidation in healthcare?
That's right.
Yeah. So I think there definitely is. If you want to be independent, then you're probably not going to be, you know, then by definition, you don't want to be consolidated. This is something that is happening across the nation. If you look at Connecticut, they have a Democratic governor who really has no bones about taking on hospitals. They're trying to lay a merger of two huge hospitals down there. I hear from people in New York about, hospitals consolidating or getting bigger and bigger. And a lot of this was incentivized under the Affordable Care Act. So it is happening everywhere. It is happening in Vermont as we see, you know, larger players getting bigger and smaller players starting to kind of fizzle out. You know, Health First said they lost 10 doctors over the course of a year, which is a lot for a small state like this. So when you hear from independent doctors, I think what you do hear is angst or worry or, you know, them saying that, you know, we can do the same things. Why do we have to be part of this? And a lot of the consolidation was incentivized under the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm. Well, Erin, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and great reporting. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike. Great to have you. Great to be on.
Thanks, Erin. That's Erin Mansfield, Vermont Digger, and we've been talking about the all-payer waiver, and we're going to be talking more about health care about once a week as we move up towards the legislative session, because it is such an important aspect of our lives and an aspect of our economy. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. So let's start where we started, which was the question: are the wheels coming off the bus of the Trump campaign? What's your opinion? 802-244-1777. Toll free at 877-291-8255. I left a lot of you hanging when we started this out in the first part of the hour. Had to move on to the healthcare guests that we had. But I'm coming back to this question. And sort of let me set it back up the way that I set it up in the first hour. The Rutland Herald had an editorial which basically says the wheels are coming off the bus with the Trump campaign. And this is the pertinent paragraph that talked about this. As the wheels come off the Trump-mobile, he has begun to behave in an ever more erratic manner. And the defenses offered by his supporters seem to be even more ludicrous. If a genius is someone who loses $1 billion, then passes the bill on to taxpayers, it's safe to say we can't afford to have many more geniuses at work in America. And let's, you know, we had David Motz on. He said he's a liberal. We understand that. He's the editorial writer for the Rutland Herald. But you go to the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal is not a liberal newspaper. And it's, especially its editorial section, and it concludes its editorial today, Mr. Trump has made so many campaign mistakes that it's a miracle he's still competitive. He owes this to the fact that a majority of Americans clearly don't want to vote for Mrs. Clinton. But the hour is late. And if he wants to win, he has to stop pursuing defensive, egotistic sideshows and focus on his plans to make America better. And one of the things that you can think of in the last few weeks or the last week and a half is that it has not been a good week and a half for Donald Trump. You can arguably say that he did a very good job in the first 30 minutes of the debate with Hillary Clinton. And then when he was talking about trade, he actually had her on her heels when he was talking about trade. But when the subject moved to other matters, he got waylaid in terms of what he was talking about. You know, his comments, when the debate drifted about back to his comments on women, his taxes, the birther issue with President Obama, and even Miss Universe, it seemed to be a different Donald Trump that came out than the first 30 minutes of the debate. And then since then, he's been made to focus on his taxes. The fact that he had a over $900 million loss in 1995 and was allowed to take those losses in subsequent years, which you're allowed to do, it's legal, take those losses in subsequent years to offset your tax liability for that particular tax year. Somebody leaked his tax forms. I mean, we can even talk about that. Should that person be prosecuted, found and prosecuted, that leaked tax forms? I hate that when people leak tax forms. I wouldn't want it on myself. I wouldn't want it done to anybody else. But nonetheless, taxes, he got waylaid on his tweets and talking about Miss Universe and the weight. He got talking about the Clinton sex lives. He mocked Hillary Clinton about her bout with pneumonia and we all saw the pictures when she sort of semi-collapsed as she was going in. He was mocking that. And we all were left sort of scratching our heads saying, what is going on? And the problem with the taxes. Look, if you're not going to release your taxes, then you better brace yourself for a tax. And you should have a game plan 5 months before the election, not 5 weeks. If you didn't think this was coming up, then there's something going on. Because you've set this up by saying you're not going to release your tax forms. Now, you can argue whether he should or shouldn't release his tax forms, but it's fair political game. And you got to admit, his campaign has not reacted very well to these political attacks. Now, the other thing is, in the debate, he never had a chance to rely on some of the policy documents that he has not really produced in terms of how he's going to make things wonderful and fabulous. So the question I have today is, are the wheels coming off the bus of the Donald Trump campaign? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. The reason I'm asking this is many people are asking this question, both conservatives and liberals alike, and be interested in your opinion. Now, we had a few phone calls in the beginning of the hour when I posed this question, and some of them said, look, he's had this terrible week, this almost terrible 2 weeks, and yet, you know, he's still competitive in Ohio, he's still competitive in North Carolina, he's still competitive elsewhere. He'll probably win the red states that he's supposed to win. Hillary Clinton will probably win the blue states that she wins. So it is a battleground discussion now. But if you're a worker in Ohio, if you're one of those workers in Ohio or Michigan or those states that he's going to need to win, North Carolina, that he's going to need to win, are you asking yourself, why am I paying taxes when Donald Trump isn't? And that's a question I think he has to contend with. And his surrogate saying that he's a genius, I don't think works. But I'd be interested in your opinion. 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Chris in Waterbury. Chris, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mike. Listen, I wanted to ask you a question. What is the goal of releasing your tax forms?
I think there are a couple of goals. One is, you know, how did you make your money? How much did you make your money? Those sort of things. I think, look, is there a law that you have to release them? No. But there's a tradition if you're running for governor or if you're running for president, that you do release them. I think it's a transparency issue, Chris. I he made the decision not to release them. That's his prerogative. There's no law that he has to. But he has to suffer the consequences politically if he doesn't. Do you agree or not?
Well, I mean, let's look at it this way. If everybody was required to release their tax forms, let's say Donald Trump released his, and his finances are absolutely in the dumper. Who would want to elect him president?
Well, that's...
You know, he made his money along with the Clintons, along with just about every practical business person in the country using the system currently in place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in my opinion, that system's been developed over a lot of years. The biggest goal from the system, I believe, was to benefit the wealthy, because in part they were the ones that, you know, did create most of the rules. They threw us middle class a few crumbs just to keep our mouths shut and satisfy us. But I think if Mr. Trump has released his tax forms, and for Hillary for that matter, if her finances were both in a dumper, what American in the right mind would want to elect him president?
Yeah, that's a good point. Chris, you make another great point, which is, does this illustrate that, you know, let's be clear here. It doesn't appear that Donald Trump did anything illegally. He abided by all the tax laws that are afforded to him. And he has a lot of lawyers to make sure that he does that. But, Chris, you make a good point. Is our tax system so complicated it only benefits the people that have those lawyers rather than the middle class? Am I getting that right?
I have an accountant look at my stuff every year, and obviously, like any American in the right mind, doesn't want to have to, especially these days, doesn't want to have to pay any more taxes because you feel like your taxes are just getting thrown away. I mean, if the American public had a better gut feeling that their taxes were being used better, they might not, you know, try to avoid paying them so much. But obviously the system was created by the rich. Like I said before, they throw us a few crumbs to keep us somewhat happy. But, you know, to try to blame people like that for using the system that's that we all benefit from is, I think, is kind of hypocritical. This flinging mud at each other is getting, you know, they both Hillary and Donald ought to be locked up. One should be locked up in an insane asylum, and the other one should be locked up in prison, and I guess I'd leave it up to the public to figure out which one goes where.
Chris, thank you very much for your phone call. Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Hallelujah to that last call. With that said, I think Donald Trump, I want to make 3 points. Donald Trump is suffering from a death of a thousand cuts. And the interesting thing, and I don't say this jokingly because I know this is an actual problem for some people, these are self-inflicted cuts. Nobody's doing this to him. He's doing it himself. Point number two is what this is really going to show us is whether or not voting with a wallet supersedes all these issues that surround Donald, because people are looking at him as being the better choice, regardless of the recent disclosures about what happened with his taxes. And then finally, to that last call, I think he's absolutely right in that what we see with Donald Trump is at least he's being honest to the extent that he said, yeah, I took a $900 million loss and I used it legally according to the system. Now look at other politicians. The Clintons became rich through politics. Bernie Sanders became rich through politics. Barack Obama became rich through politics. His wife had a $300,000 a year job at a hospital while he was senator. As soon as he was no longer senator, the job went away. How many minority women, black women, could that have paid for as opposed to her, with a husband who was making $100,000+ a year? She took a job that could have hired 5 or 6, you know, African-American women who probably were just as qualified as she was for that job. But the point being is that across the board, Republican and Democrat, what we're doing in this country is creating a bunch of elites through politics and power, and it's not benefiting any of us.
Thanks, Paul, for your phone call. Let's go to Jack in Bridport. Jack, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Let's talk about Hillary for a minute there. You know, when she was being investigated by the FBI there, she seems to have this convenient memory loss there, amnesia or whatever it is, because there was 39 times that she could not recall. And also, it must have been a little contagious because her aides, her closest aides, they had something like the total of it, I guess, was 320 times they couldn't recall. So, I don't know. She seems like a sick person to me.
Thanks, Jack, for your phone call. You know, Hillary Clinton has her own issues. I mean, the American public does not trust Hillary Clinton. And one of the reasons they don't trust her is something that Jack brought up, is they don't believe her on her explanations on this email. That's just one. I think she's built up a trust factor with other issues as well. And it's interesting. I haven't looked at it recently, but if you remember maybe about a month and a half ago, there was a poll that had three people on the ballot, three entities on the ballot, Mr. Trump, Mrs. Clinton, and none of the above, basically. I think someone other. And if you remember correctly, somebody else won in terms of those three. So both of these people, and we've never seen this in U.S. politics. We've never seen this in U.S. politics where we've had this sort of dissatisfaction with both candidates that we will have to elect. We're going to elect one of these people. The question is, it doesn't seem like we're going to be happy with any of the choices that we have. And that may be speaking to much more of the system than anything else. One of the other things I wanted to bring up is there's an Associated Press story today that talks about the governor's use of a 1960 plane, a plane that none of his predecessors would use. In fact, Republican Jim Douglas and Democratic Howard Dean did not use the airplane. So the question I had, and we're not going to have time to get to this. I can see this coming as I'm looking at the clock. And we've got about 4 minutes to go, and one of the things, so let me just explain, maybe we can get to it, the way, it seems like we've elected Governor Dangerous here, because here's the quote, you know, Peter Shumlin doesn't mind flying in a state airplane that's a half a century old, even when his two predecessors declined to use it. The reason they declined to use it is that state police told them, which provides security for governors, told them that it wasn't safe to use. And here's Governor Shumlin saying, "I was born without a fear gene." He's saying that when the security, he said this, he joked that the 1960 four-seater Cessna is his security team's nightmare and a lieutenant governor's dream. You know, he talks about the door handle. Look, the door handle opening on a small plane is nothing unusual. It happens. And if you're ever a skydiver, that happens as well. But, you know, those are the sort of things that you kind of shake your head when you read this and say, what's the governor's point here? Is he trying to be Governor Dangerous? Is he trying to be Dr. Dangerous? Is he trying to be something else? You know, I got a few phone calls here, and it could be on the Trump issue, could be on this issue, but let's try to fit them in. We've got 3 minutes left. That means about 30 seconds apiece. Rick from Essex. Rick, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, Mike. Just want to offer my impression. Yeah, both, as you said, both Trump and Hillary have major issues, but my impression is that you, as is true of most of the media, put most of your focus on Trump and not nearly as much on Hillary. Thanks.
Thanks, Rick. Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on open mic.
Yeah, the state police don't give airworthy certificates. So if the FAA gave that airplane an airworthy certificate, it's safe.
Thank you, Fred, from Newberry. So Fred agrees that we give a break to Governor Dangerous and his feeling to fly the airplane. I think from a security point of view, it's not the airworthiness that they're looking at. It's the various variables that come into flying with a small aircraft, especially a single engine aircraft. And that is pretty much what we are going to sort of get to today. Hey, Tom, I don't have my typical sort of sheet here to go over, but I'll find it and we'll go from there. Hey, I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Joe Haddock, who is with Health First here in Vermont, talking about independent providers, independent physicians, and the topic of their place in the system and healthcare reimbursement. I also want to thank Aaron Mansfield and from Vermont Digger and Victoria Jones from Talk Media News, and thank them for everything. And of course, I want to thank all you. We had a lot of phone calls today. I really appreciate it. Some I didn't get to, and I apologize to this. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.